Well, good evening. This is like a family reunion. This is wonderful. My goodness, so nice to see you all. This is a treat. Is there a problem?
We're trying to get the light up there.
Oh, I can see without.
Okay. But you're going to might read.
Yeah, I can. So far, I can see fine. Well, meanwhile, why don't we? Yeah, that's good. Why don't we do introductions around?
Friend, this label even.
So I'm Marie, Judy,
Ellie,
Karen,
Karin,
Jeffrey,
Ross,
Samia,
Paul,
Jennifer,
Israel,
Bob,
Wendy.
Well, some of us have spent the week up at Jikoji sitting and walking and sitting and walking and sitting and walking some more, and washing dozens of dishes, sweeping the decks, and scrubbing the toilets, and doing... Lily is nodding her head. It's such an interesting combination of the austerity in the Zendo and the enormous amount of work that goes into sustaining 15 or 20 people for a week in one place. And because it's around the practice of meditation, there are certain aspects that are emphasized. One being that we don't talk with each other unless absolutely necessary. And so there is a hush in the enterprise that creates an atmosphere of... it allows... I don't know what you call the atmosphere, but it allows people to begin to experience each other in a new way. If you can't just come up and chat to somebody or ask them something, if you have to work out some kind of quiet way of making a connection, then everything changes. And that's why the quiet is requested. It's called noble silence, because with that silence comes a whole new experience with other people. And because it's a collection of all little by little, it becomes one family. We're all breathing together and bumping into each other and stumbling on the same path and washing the same dishes and doing it all together. So it starts out being very clumsy and awkward, and nobody quite knows what to do. And then it gets a little bit melded, and then people get a little lonely and grumpy because they aren't talking and being with their bodies in the same way or being with people in the same way. And then slowly the grumpiness begins to go away. And then there's the opportunity in sitting to truly meet ourselves, to truly be present. There isn't any extra enlightenment that goes with the practice. The practice itself is enlightenment itself. Sometimes somebody will have been reading a lot or had a special experience the session before, and then just labor and labor on the cushion trying to get it back again or create some special experience. But as Uchiyama Roshi, I just was reading in Bendoa, says this is not, you can't make anything happen. The you of making things happen is not the you of Zazen at all. Sometimes we have to say, oh, please come to me, Zazen. It's well to be a little humble, but not too humble, because we do bring a deep intention, a very strong intention to our body, our breath, our mind, with every sit. So those who couldn't come, I hope you can come next time. And those who did come and were so enormously helpful, hope you can come some more. it was amazing to and humbling to see how people were able to work together in such a beautiful and coherent way. It's not usual in our ordinary everyday life. It's really not very usual. But we come away with the possibility, oh, we could be kind of like that all the time. So we're still studying Bendoa. We're toward the end of it. And I think we're on the 14th question. Now, I am open to being corrected if somebody knows better. The 14th one is, the question is, monks quickly depart from their involvements and have no obstacles to wholeheartedly engaging the way of Zazen. Monks have got it great. What a cushy life. But how can people in the world who are busy with their duties single-mindedly practice and be in accord with the Buddha way of non-action? So that was the question brought to Dogen. And he said, certainly Buddha ancestors with their great sympathy keep open the vast gate of compassion in order to allow all living beings to enter enlightenment. So which of the various beings would not enter? There are an awful lot of different kinds of beings. Where would you draw the line? And then he offers a lot of examples from antiquity to the present of his time. Prime minister, minister of state named Ho, a high official who wrote a poem expressing himself about enjoying Zazen in his spare time from state affairs. And there was an emperor and great ministers in Great Song China now in his time. He said, if the genuine Buddha Dharma permeates the country, because of Buddha's and heavenly beings' ceaseless protection, the emperor's reign will be peaceful. If the reign is peaceful, Buddha Dharma attains its strength. He said, even in Shakyamuni Buddha's time, criminals took up Zazen. Criminals, having met Shakyamuni Buddha, became followers of Buddha. You all probably know Angulimala's story, or maybe not. Angulimala Uchiyama Roshi tells it differently from the way I heard it, but the way I heard it, Angulimala's mother was murdered by someone, and very cruelly, and he was so appalled that he vowed that he would kill 100 people, Angulimala. He was going to make a mala, a necklace, with the fingers of 100 people that he killed. Really gruesome. So he had got to a village and had come to his, he'd already finished off 99, and so there was just one more finger he was looking for. And Shakyamuni Buddha came along at the same time to the same village and said to someone, I think I'll take a walk out that little road out there. And they said, oh, don't go out there, Buddha. That's where Angulimala is hanging out and waiting for the next thing, the last finger. And Buddha said, I think I'll go anyway. And so he walked out there, and Angulimala jumped out of the bushes and said, stop, stop. And Buddha said, I have stopped, Angulimala. How about you? And that changed his mind. So Angulimala had taken on such terrible karma that he didn't live very long, and people all knew how bad he had been, so they all threw rocks at him wherever he went. He had a sort of miserable life, but he stuck with Buddha all the way through till he died. It's a very sad story, really. And who knows, but it certainly points to some sort of salvation for all of us, for whatever foolishnesses we're up to. Stopping is always an option. So Uchiyama Roshi has beautiful things to say about this little piece, this question about monks and ordinary people. And it's so essential for us because we are the ordinary people they're talking about. We're not monks. We're just ordinary. And even some monks call themselves ordinary, like Dalai Lama always reminds us that he's an ordinary monk. Just ordinary. The first idea about monks is that they live a cushy life, but of course they live a very hard life. They're supporting themselves and they're washing the dishes and doing all the things that we do during Sesshin. They're keeping the whole operation going, and somebody has to be in charge, and somebody has to be the cook, and somebody... So it's... Then they have a week, a month, where they sit long sits, but still somebody is maintaining the whole situation, so it's not an easy life at all. Uchiyama Roshi says people lose sight of the fact that it's best to be ordinary. They think something with a special color is better than something plain. The most difficult is to be exactly as life is. We think that this or that with our brain, though what we think is not reality. But thinking isn't bad. The true reality of human life is that we are living with the brain. What we think in our brain is not reality, but illusion. So he says we having a brain, we do produce thoughts. We're squirting out thoughts all the time. And so that's real. And when we sit, we encounter the thoughts and begin to sense that it's just going on all the time. All this stuff is going on in my head all the time. Is that all? Is that all of my life? He said, this point about brain function produces thought in reality, this point gives us the most difficulty when we try to live in accordance with the reality of human life. Knowing that what we think is illusion, we must allow our brain to keep vividly working because this is the reality of life without human fabrication. It's just what happens. We keep our brain functioning vividly as it is, so we're not sitting to wipe out our thought. We're not sitting to throw away ourself. He says, our zazen, we are not caught up in the illusory thoughts. We don't attach to them. We don't become very fond of some kinds of them and try to avoid and throw away other kinds of them, but we simply encounter each thought as it comes. And then we let it go because it always goes. It's always coming and it's always going. And he said, the posture of zazen, of letting go of thought. And even if we let go of thought, of course they come up ceaselessly, but we don't put ourselves into them. We just keep actualizing the reality of life. Just keep being where we are. Not where we're going next, not where we have just been, not when where we were 10 years ago or what we read in the newspaper or any of the things that go on in our mind all the time. The only reality is the one that we're in. It's weird. I know, it's quite weird because we have all this other stuff going on all the time. But it's all illusion. And then Uchiyama Roshi goes into this very touching thing about his childhood and how overprotected he had been. He says his mother... Japanese children are, as boys, Japanese boys are very protected, adored by their mothers. And he said, I only knew how to criticize or blame other people's faults, yet I couldn't do anything myself. And then he read Rousseau, and Rousseau insisted on going back to nature and raising children in tune with nature, which was a very new thought in Rousseau's time, and certainly was in Uchiyama Roshi's Japanese time too. So it made a big difference in his life. He saw that he was separate from nature. And then wondered how he could become connected because he had no ability. He couldn't ride a bike. He couldn't do sports. He was not a kind of back to nature person at all. It's very touching. He called himself a good for nothing person. I never had the praiseworthy resolution to lead monks in doing things. When I was ordained, I only decided to try to follow other monks in some way. And then he said, unexpectedly, the day I was ordained was December 8th, 1941, the Pearl Harbor Day, and the Japanese bombed America. And senior monks were drafted and went into the army or went to work for the government, so everybody left the monastery and only useless monks like me remained, he said. He said we were in the worst condition. No matter how resolved one might be, practitioners couldn't overcome such difficulties. Only with way-seeking mind or willpower, all monks began to do different things according to their preference. Although I expected to be led by the divine power of assembly, I couldn't rely on the other monks anymore. I found that I would lose direction if I did things with them. And then I reconsidered. After all, I could rely only on myself. No one could live my life for me. Furthermore, I hadn't solved the problem of death. If I couldn't rely on the community of practitioners, I would have to face my own death by myself. If I stopped practice halfway, I would have terrible fear when I had to die. That was his final impetus. After all, practice should be done by oneself. Only I can live my own life and die my own death. I couldn't help but continue to practice. He's very honest, beautifully honest. He said, when we sit, the world of Zazen is opened as much as we sit. Therefore, it has nothing to do with whether we are weak-minded or strong-minded. Numbers of people became my disciples probably only because I guarantee that the world of Zazen opens even when a weak person like me practices Zazen. My disciples must think they are stronger than me. Therefore, they can become my disciples without worrying about whether they can be a real Zen monk or not. I like that. If he's not special, then they don't have to be special either. But then he talks about the difference between lay people's practice and monks' practice. He says, lay people's practice is all right as it is. That is to sit as much as they have time. That's for sure, for all of us. And such a busy life we mostly have. And yet, we can always find time. There is always at least 10 minutes in every day where we can withdraw. He said, monks have a responsibility to become locomotives which draw people. This is the difference between lay people and monks. So monks must have strong power and they must not deviate in practice. It is not permissible for monks to lose their direction while they are leading others. But with the exception of becoming such locomotives, Lay people can practice Dogen, Zenji, Zazen just as monks can, just as we've been doing at Jikoji. For a little while, everybody becomes a monk. It's a very nice feeling. He said, when we sit, we have to let go of thoughts, which are our own measurements or value judgments, which say, I'm no good, or I despair of myself. None of those, that kind of thinking, which is so unuseful and so common. We have learned all through our life to judge ourselves, to monitor our experience and figure out how we're doing. And mostly our conditioning is to keep us feeling off balance and not confident in this. So he says the world of Zazen opens when we let go of our value judgments. As soon as we stop laying a trip on ourselves or on others or on anything, then the world of Zazen opens up wherever we are. So he finishes up by saying, Zazen should be strictly good for nothing. It is vital to just practice this good for nothing practice. Very encouraging. So are there questions? Comments? Wendy?
So if the only reality is the present, how do you learn from your mistakes and experiences?
Well, you have them in your memory.
Yes.
So, but you know your memory is not to be dependent on.
Right.
So, it's helpful to have a memory and try to use what we remember to instruct us, but also be realistic about it that you may be wrong. In other words, there is nothing to depend on. That's the bottom line of the whole teaching. There is really, in the end, nothing to be depending on. We can't depend on our memory. We can't depend on other people except up to a certain point. Of course, we do depend on each other, but when it comes to the crunchy part, we have to die all by ourselves. And that was his discovery. Oh, it's just me. Wow. And then with that realization, to sit down and really be with that, a whole new thing opens up. That's why we sit in that undependable state, that place where there is no place to stand, is where we begin to develop insight, because it's the truth. And suddenly we're face to face with the truth of things rather than what we want it to be like.
So then you bring that sense of nothing to depend on and the present into your daily life.
Mm-hmm.
We're using critical thinking and analysis.
Oh, it's very important to have critical thinking and analysis,
right.
but not to be depending on it, because it can only carry us so far. And it doesn't touch the truth.
But it's not totally an illusion.
Well,
there's different truths.
Yes, a different truth. Right.
Yes.
Right. Paul?
Just aside, Einstein once said that reality is particularly persuasive illusion.
Particularly
persuasive and persistent.
And
illusion.
Yes.
The physicists aren't so far from sitting.
Well, certainly Einstein wasn't.
No.
He really had the whole, had the picture. Yeah. Samuel?
Did Buddha have a lot of students?
Yes.
Like, were they numbered, or were they like in the Bible, he had, what, 12 or 13 students, Jesus?
He had some senior students who were with him, three or four of them, that it wasn't made a big deal about how many they were.
Mm-hmm.
Shariputra was one, Moggallana was one, Mahakashapa was one, Ananda. Those four, I would say, would be his primary disciples.
And did he know that obviously he was a teacher, but did he decide that he's going to do the teaching, like, okay, I'm a teacher, where are the students?
When he was enlightened, he thought that nobody would understand what he was understanding.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I don't think it's worth even talking about this because nobody will get it. I think we all know that feeling. It's really hard to explain it when people ask, what are you doing? And you can't say. And then he remembered that he had three friends that had been practicing the austerities, the yogi austerities, for a long time together. And they were really mad at him and went off in a huff because he stopped being austere and actually ate something. And so he sought them out in Varanasi. He took a long, long walk from where he was to Varanasi and found them. And because he had decided that maybe they could get it.
Mm-hmm.
And so then he went to them and explained what he had discovered in a sort of scientific way. You know, the Eightfold Path and the circle of all of those things that were the original experience that he had. And they got it. And so that was the beginning. And he realized that it was possible for people and that it was well to share it.
Is this like an example for somebody that kind of pisses you off, and if you really are on the path, you wouldn't get upset because you know that they don't know?
oh, you might get upset. Mm-hmm. Not with them, but you would feel a frustration in your own mind about your ability to convince them of something. You wouldn't be mad at them. You'd be mad at you would be feeling a frustration in yourself that there's this gap between you.
Which happened to Buddha when he got enlightened. Therefore, he told his friends.
Yes, he shared with his friends.
If you give the message clearly, they should get it. And if they don't get it, that means you didn't give the message clearly.
Oh, I don't think so. There's a famous time when he was during the rains period, the monks all came together with him, and the monks got in an argument. There were one faction that thought there was a particular way of filling a bucket, mm-hmm. and another faction thought there was another way of doing it. And they couldn't agree, and they went to Buddha and said, okay, we've got this big problem. Would you please solve it for us? And he said, no, I can't do that. You do it. It's up to you. And they couldn't decide. And he said, I can't deal with this. And he went off, and they say, like an old Tusker elephant, and sat in the woods for a long time. And finally they came to him, some of them, and said, please come back. We fixed it. It's okay. So I'm sure he was extremely annoyed. And that's
so,
what
so
how
to let things go sometimes and say, you know, this is beyond me.
Yes.
I'm just going to go in the woods.
Yes. Yes.
Just hide from those people.
Yeah, right. If it's bothering you,
right.
And you can't do anything about it.
You can rise above everything.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Yeah, and be aware of what those feelings are in you. It's not really about the other person. It's about your own feeling about what's happening. And then you can decide what to do.
So if you're perceived as hard and not kind or not understanding, that's okay.
Absolutely. There are a lot of times when we better not be understanding, mm. when we better be strict. Mm. There are situations that require it. Mm. Good luck. It's after 8. Announcements?
One short one. Percy, it's tomorrow night. Somebody wants to watch Meteor Shower.
Where do we go?
Just in your backyard.
No, you can't see stars.
Not in my backyard.
You should see bright ones. You can go to Grant Ranch. You can go to Henry Cole Park. You can get out of town.
Yeah, I just was out of town.
Is that tonight? Tonight is
tomorrow.
What time?
About 10 to 2.
It's fabulous to see. Sophie and I were in
a minute. I was at Yosemite 2 years ago.
Yeah, Sophie and I did it in the Sierras.
I was up here in Mono Lake. In the hot spring.
Wow. Oh, wow, Jennifer. Woo. Well, it's worth getting up for. Karen?
Will you remind me the book that we're doing next time?
Oh, yes, I brought it to show you. Thank you for reminding me. This is one version of it. I think they're different covers. But it's Dogen and Uchiyama, and it's called Refining Your Life, or From the Zen Kitchen to Enlightenment. And it's about cooking, about the attitude and atmosphere you bring to whatever you do, but in this case, the rice and the vegetables, the soup, and your mind. And Uchiyama Roshi, again, has very wonderful things to say. So, I think there are two more in here, and then we'll be done with Bendoa, and then we'll go on to this one.
Is there another book that has a different name? Something, How to Cook Your Life. Is that different?
That's the same one, I think.
I think it's the same book.
Yes.
I think it's a later version.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know why they switched around. They must have switched publishers, probably.
It seemed like the same description.
Yes. Yeah. So, are we all set for the month as far as opening and closing?
Well, Marie's back.
Yay.
She's not an opener. I'm not that organized. I just keep
okay.
emailing people.
Yeah.
But, is Jeffrey opening next week, or have you given it up?
Yeah, I think somebody else can open.
Okay. Did you want to open? Are you enjoying it, or did you just you did it last week? And
I can do it. Never mind.
No. That sounds great. You have a key.
Yeah.
If you have questions, you could see one of us.
Okay. I should get your email.
Yeah, good idea. Thank you for opening this.
Yeah, no problem. I got it. Bike tire flat,
but
oh,
no.
No.
Oh gosh.
Yes, it takes
now. There's one more thing, and that is that there's a little occasion, I don't know what else to call it, at Samia's house on Saturday, to which everyone is invited. Some people in the Sangha worked long and hard to make a new one of these for me. And it's going to be given to me on that afternoon at Samia's house. So you all are invited. Please tell Samia if you're coming before Thursday. Is that the deadline?
Yeah, Friday.
Thursday or Friday, okay.
But if you don't have my information, please see me. Or if you didn't get the email.
It's mostly a chance to get together and have some tea and treats. And enjoy
in
each other.
Place, there's always food.
Right. Okay.